It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the Buddhist ancestors, all the way back from Shakyamuni Buddha. So just to review, dana, or offering, is the foundation of all four embracing actions. Loving speech is an offering that uses language. Beneficial action is an offering using body and mind. And identity action is a method we can use to make our offerings acceptable to others. Today's talk is on the third embracing action, beneficial actions. And I'm going to read again, as I have in the previous talks, Dogen's definition, a little passage from Dogen, and then review Okamura Roshi's commentary. That's so much, very helpful. So Dogen begins by saying, beneficial action is simply creating skillful means to benefit living beings. That's simple. Whether they're noble or humble, it doesn't matter who they are. For example, we care for the near and distant future of others and use skillful means to benefit them. We should take pity on a cornered tortoise and care for a sick sparrow. When we see this tortoise or sparrow, we try to help them without expecting any reward. We are motivated solely by beneficial action itself. Some very clear statement from Dogen. So in this section, Dogen gives two examples of beneficial action that are directed towards small living beings. And he shows that these helping activities arise solely from a compassionate heart rather than a calculating mind, emphasizing that beneficial action is done solely for itself. According to Dogen, beneficial actions return to those who perform them without any expectation of reward. Yet, there's a paradox. When a person performs a beneficial action without expecting any reward, that person receives some benefit in return for that action. However, if a person helps others with some expectation of reward, such actions essentially become a means of barter and therefore produce no reward. So Dogen says that actions can either be defiled or pure, depending on the motivation of the person performing them. If a person performs a generous act without any expectation of personal gain, the person does receive a reward. If the person has even the slightest expectation of a reward, however, the action is defiled and the person definitely does not receive a reward. And Roshi says, this is very strange logic. But that is what Dogen says. So Roshi tells us then, he explains two stories about this. Kangyu, who lived in the Jin Dynasty China, very old China, met a person on the road who was carrying a basket on his shoulder that contained a captured tortoise. These are the stories that Dogen was drawing from in Chinese literature, from Chinese literature, that cultured people in Japan were very familiar with. So this is a story of this is one of the two stories. So Kongyu lived in ancient China, and he met a person on the road carrying a basket on his shoulder that contained a captured tortoise. Kongyu, seeing the poor tortoise was suffering, aroused a compassionate heart and gave the person some money for the tortoise. When Kongyu released it to the river, the tortoise turned its head to the left to look back at him in a gesture of gratitude as it headed to its home. Many years later, Kongyu became the governor of the region in which he released the tortoise. As was the custom, shortly after being installed, he designed the governor's official stamp. The stamp was to bear the head of a tortoise, but the finished image inexplicably showed the tortoise with its head turned to the left. Kongyu had the stamp remade 3 times, but each time the head of the tortoise was turned in the same way. Then he remembered that the tortoise he released many years before had looked back at him 3 times, turning its head to the left. He realized that he had become governor as a result of the tortoise's aid and protection. And another story about Yangbo of a later Han dynasty contains a similar theme. When he was 9 years old, Yangbo found a sick sparrow on the ground that was being attacked by ants. Yangbo took the bird home, and after nursing it back to health, he released it. Later, when Yangbo was an adult, the sparrow came to him in a dream. It appeared to him in the form of a yellow-robed boy offering 4 white rings. According to the story, Yangbo's family enjoyed prosperity for 4 generations as a result of the sparrow's protection. So, in order to present Buddhist teachings of beneficial action more understandably to Japanese people, Dogen used such stories from Chinese classical literature because they were well known among educated people of his day. But they are darling stories. Remember what we learned about studying Zen history and culture. When it's not true, it's more important. Do you remember that? We had this a while back. When it's not true, it's more important because we learn so much about the Chinese spiritual imagination. So here are 2 really good examples. It's hard actually to believe such stories, yet the one about the tortoise is almost unforgettable. So, I mean, who cares if it's true, really? So Dogen continues. An ignorant person may think that if we benefit others too much, our own benefit will be excluded. This is not the case. Beneficial action is the whole of Dharma. It benefits both self and others widely. And the commentary, when we vow to adopt beneficial action as a bodhisattva practice, we must try to do what is best for all living beings without discriminating between noble or humble, rich or poor, friends or enemies. The Buddha said, though through hatred, hatreds are never appeased. Through non-hatred, hatreds are always appeased. This is an eternal law. Christ said, you have heard it said that you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward will you have? Jesus said that we should love our enemies. To love families, relatives, and friends is a matter of course. In Buddhism, our ability to love our enemies determines our ability to be bodhisattvas. Buddhist teaching and Christ's teaching are the same on this point. Can we carry out these teachings, though? This idea of loving our enemies, which we have a lot of opportunity to do in these days, I must say. Can we do it? And it's usually very difficult for us to do. In fact, if we can love someone, that person is not our enemy. People become our enemies because we can't love them. So each of us must transform our consciousness and go beyond discriminations between friends and enemies. Buddha and Christ were people who could make that transformation. And there have been other people, such as Mahatma Gandhi. Dogen taught in the Shishobo that we should act in accordance with what is best for the sake of all beings. To do this, we must act without concern for whether people are noble or humble, whether they are people we love or strangers, or even whether they're considered to be our friends or enemies. An example of this is in the Lotus Sutra, in a chapter called Bodhisattva Never Disparaging. This is very famous. So it's a chapter about a bodhisattva who made prostrations to everyone he met, saying, "I will never disparage you because in the future you will attain Buddhahood." So he went around and he bowed to everybody he saw in the street and he said that. Other monks and lay people were arguing about Buddhist teachings, each trying to prove their own understanding was best. But Bodhisattva, never disparaging, did not study systems of doctrine or meditation. He just walked the streets and made prostrations to whomever he met, saying he would never disparage them because they would someday become Buddhas. Those who were arguing did not like this Bodhisattva, because he would not choose sides in an argument. He said he respected everyone involved in any argument since they were all bodhisattvas. From the perspective of the people arguing and fighting, a person who respected all points of view could not be a friend. Sometimes people even beat or threw stones at bodhisattva never disparaging, but as long as he lived, he did not stop his practice of honoring everyone he met. According to the story, when he was dying, he was able to see the reality of all beings, even though he had never studied any system of Buddhist teachings. He accepted, upheld, and expounded this reality and attained eternal life. In other words, he attained enlightenment. People who had despised him became his followers. But notice that even though he had never studied a system of Buddhist teachings, he had a practice, which he did all day, every day. Practice is a Buddhist system. Just saying. So back to Dogen. In an ancient era, a man who tied up his hair three times while he took a bath and who stopped eating three times in the space of one meal solely intended to benefit others. He never withheld truths from people of other countries. This example is from the Chinese classic Shiji. When the Lord Zhougong sent his son to govern the country of Lu, his son came to say farewell. At that time, Zhougong admonished him, saying, "I am a son of King Wen, the younger brother of King Wu, and the uncle of King Cheng, and I therefore am not a person of humble birth. Yet I tied up my hair 3 times while bathing and stopped eating 3 times in the space of one meal." In other words, he interrupted his own pleasures. "In order to meet with gentlemen who wish to offer me their opinions in person, I am fearful that we will lose wise people in this country. When you arrive in the country of Lu, be careful not to disparage its people, even though you will be the governor." Zhougong sent his son to a neighboring country that was a dependent of his own more powerful country. And he told his son that even though his son would be a governor, he should not miss any opportunity to meet and listen to any wise people of Lu. Dogen continues, "Therefore, we should equally benefit friends and foes alike. We should benefit self and others alike, because beneficial actions never regress. If we attain such a mind, we can perform beneficial action even for grass, trees, wind, and water. We should strive solely to benefit ignorant beings." But as I first mentioned in the very first talk on the Shishobo, the Shishobo was written 2 months before Dogen Zenji and his assembly abruptly moved from the then capital city of Kyoto into the deeply remote mountains of Eshijin. It's called Eshizen. He was likely not, so this is really important. He was very, almost for sure, not living in a peaceful environment when he wrote the Four Embracing Actions of Bodhisattva Practice. At this time, the Japanese Buddhist establishment was trying to oppress Dogen's newly introduced Chinese style of Zen Buddhism. And it was in this condition of great conflict. Remember, he was afraid that they were going to burn his temple down. I mean, it was really a conflictual moment. And he fled. He and his assembly fled to the North Country. And I remember I told you the story about they didn't have a kitchen and they had to lug their meals up the hill in the snow. The Tenzo had to do that. Anyway, so it was in this condition of great conflict that Dogen wrote, "Therefore, we should equally benefit friends and foes alike. We should benefit self and others alike." One of the reasons Dogen moved from Kyoto was to avoid conflict with the established religious institution. When we study the background of Shishobo, we can more clearly understand the significance of these words of Dogen, quote, "beneficial, because beneficial actions never regress. If we attain such a mind, we can perform beneficial action even for grass, trees, wind, and water. We should strive solely to benefit ignorant beings." This was Dogen's faith and wish. He did not think it meaningful to fight against the religious establishment. Rather, he practiced the Bodhisattva vow to help all beings that suffer within the cycle of transmigration in samsara. His enemies, the Tendai monks, who held religious and political power, were not excluded from this vow. I feel that's just really powerful that he wrote those words, you know, when his life was at stake, really, because of conflict with, well, not his conflict, the establishment had a conflict with him. But nevertheless, he said, you know, do beneficial actions even for your enemies. So now I'd like to end with this wonderful story written by Shoryu Bradley, a Zen priest in the Okamura Roshi lineage, on the subject of beneficial action. I want to share it with you because I found it so apt and so moving. It's called Practice for Its Own Sake, Story of a Solitary Monk and His Dog Monty. So this is what he wrote. This is what this priest wrote. One thing I find so compelling about this part of Shobo Genzo is that it seems Dogen Zenji openly reveals to us his tender heart, saying it is tenderness itself that is the center of his teachings and the essence of the Dharma. I find it especially endearing that he uses stories about these two gentle, ordinary creatures, a tortoise and a sparrow, to illustrate the attitude we adopt when practicing beneficial action. It shows us in a simple and beautiful way, what it means to practice the Dharma for its own sake. Many times I've pulled over from one of our winding mountain roads in northwest Arkansas to take a box turtle out of harm's way. I'm not sure my motivation to help a turtle at these times is always completely pure. If I analyzed it, I might find some underlying desire to feel I'm a good person doing a good deed, for example. And I think it's important to make an effort to recognize how we can get off track in this way. But I believe the initial impulse to simply stop and help before thinking too much about it is just life expressing itself. In that instant, picking up a box turtle and moving it to safety seems as natural as if I myself were stepping out of the path of traffic. There's no time or need to hesitate or doubt my motivations or actions. In Okamura Roshi's commentary to Dogen Zenji's teaching on beneficial action, he explains how Dogen Zenji used well-known traditional stories about a cornered turtle and a sick sparrow to illustrate how beneficial actions, when done for its own sake, actually benefits the giver enormously. Today, we may find the magical words of these stories beautiful and intriguing, but of course we don't really believe that an animal we encounter by chance like this can really transform our lives in such a deep way. But I'll go on record saying that I have encountered the power of an animal to exert a deep transformative influence on my life. One hot August afternoon in 2012, about 8 months after I had moved to these remote woods of northwest Arkansas, I saw an SUV making its way down our steep, unpaved driveway. And to my surprise, I also saw what appeared to be a small dog clumsily loping down the drive behind it. A lady from the local assessor's office got out of the car and greeted me, telling me she was making a routine visit on behalf of the county, and she apologized for leading the dog onto our property. Upon looking at the dog more closely, I could see he was just a puppy, probably some kind of shepherd or collie mix. He was panting profusely, and looking up to the lady in what seemed to be an exhausted desperation, watching her every move. Occasionally, he would look to me as well, as if he were searching for some sign from one of us that he would be accepted. The lady told me she had encountered the puppy on the road and given him a drink of her bottled water, and he had then followed her to our property. She again apologized, but asked whether I might want to keep him. She said she had owned several herding dogs like him, and they had made excellent companions. Before the lady had finished speaking about the puppy, I knew I couldn't, quote, I couldn't take him. Gyobutsuji was to be a monastic practice place, and we couldn't have a dog here. After all, barking during Zazen and distracting people who might come to practice. There was also the vet and food expenses. At that point, I wasn't even sure how I was going to support my own practice. There was just no way I could have a dog here. I was sure of that. When I told my visitor, she said she understood and she was sure the puppy would follow her on her way out. And she was right about that. And after her brief visit, I watched him again loping after the SUV in the opposite direction. As I saw them disappear in the distance, I noticed a funny feeling in the pit of my stomach, and I couldn't get the sight of the puppy's bright, intelligent, and pleading eyes out of my mind. I'd never encountered a dog quite like him. I don't really know how to explain it, and it may sound silly to try, but it was as if I could feel some kind of depth and yearning for connection that I had never felt in the presence of an animal before. In those moments, I felt some kind of space opening up in my mind and heart, and I began to wish I had taken the puppy in. What would become of this beautiful being? Would someone take him in before the coyotes got him, or he died of thirst? How could I have been so hard-hearted and fixated on my own ideas of the way things had to be? As I walked with these thoughts whirling around my head, my heart felt heavier with each step. But suddenly, to my surprise, the puppy appeared by my side. He must have found his way back after he could no longer keep up with the SUV. He looked up desperately and imploringly, as if searching my face for some signal that would allow him to stay. I said to myself, well, let's give this a try. This is truly a being in need. I named him Monty, and as it turned out, I'm not sure who needed who more in this relationship. The gangly puppy grew to be a lovely, sensitive, and incredibly intelligent dog who is, as I later learned from a border collie breeder, a purebred border collie, likely imported from Scotland. How he found his way to these dusty rural roads of Northwest Arkansas, only he knows, but I am deeply grateful he did. Far from being a distraction from practice, Monty's presence at Gyobutsuji has been a gift. He rarely barks, and usually when he does, I feel he's just doing his part to protect our property. It took very little effort to teach him not to enter the zendo, but in a way he participates in our sesshins by patiently and quietly waiting out each five-day period in the adjacent room. He greets all of our visitors with unabashed joy, and most of them end up loving him before they leave. I imagine he makes most of them feel more welcome and relaxed than any human could, and he seems to truly love everyone he encounters. I have learned much about Bodhisattva practice from this amazing being, and he has shown me so many things about love, affection, discipline, commitment, companionship, jealousy, compassion, and more. One reason I love him so much is that it seems Monty is always just being Monty, and often in doing so, he reveals to me my own heart and mind. I remember a time, for instance, when he showed me just how fragile my emotional composure can be. For years, when I first moved to Gyobutsuji, I think I tried to keep myself convinced that I was content in my solitude so long as I could sit zazen. Of course, I wanted to offer sesshin practice to others, but few people joined me in those days. Regardless, I would get by fine without companionship, I thought. I had my practice and my aspiration, and that would be enough. I resolved to just keep sitting and to avoid letting the occasional bouts of loneliness distract me. During those early days, I would leave Monty outside on the property when I went to town for supplies. I understood that others in the area had done the same with their dogs, and I was certain he would stick close to home while I was away. But one afternoon, as I drove down our driveway after returning from a town trip, he didn't show up to greet me as he always had before. I thought it was odd, and again, an uncomfortable feeling in the pit of my stomach began to grow as I approached the main building. I got out of my car and called to him, "No, Monty." I called and called again, but still, "No, Monty." As my heart began beating faster, my mind raced, wondering where he could be. I called for a while longer and then sat down to think. Why would he leave? Could it be possible someone had come to the property and taken him away? No, of course that was unlikely. Probably he had caught the scent of a rabbit or armadillo and strayed into the woods. Then I realized if someone did happen to find him, they couldn't notify me because it just so happened during the previous day, he had somehow lost his collar while running through the brush. My thoughts went on like this until I decided to try to alleviate my growing anxiety by driving the country road to look for him. But I had no luck. He was nowhere to be found. That evening, after the sun had gone down, I could think of nothing but Monty. It had been hours since I had returned home, and I was certain he couldn't survive a night alone in the woods. The coyotes were sure to get him. I shuddered at the thought, and tears began to roll down my face. I had trouble sleeping that night, and I could only weep when I thought of Monty facing coyotes. My little friend was gone. I hadn't known how attached I had become to him. The next day, I went looking again on the country road, though I wasn't hopeful. As I drove, I decided to stop at my neighbor's house and ask if they had seen him. I figured it was a long shot, but to my surprise, my neighbor said he thought he had seen a collie chasing his neighbor's truck the day before. He suggested I go check with him. As I approached his house, I saw a dog tied up in the yard, and I knew instantly it was Monty. He started wagging and whining when he saw me, and I couldn't remember feeling more overjoyed and relieved. I was so happy to be reunited with my little companion. He must have followed my car onto the road as I drove out to get supplies. When the driver of the truck hadn't found a collar on him, he assumed he was a stray and took him in. With this incident, Monty had shown me who I was, that I had been pretending to myself to be someone else. I wasn't an iron monk who needed nothing but zazen. He showed me how easily my world could be turned upside down. These days, I even wonder if I would have been able to endure the many dark, solitary winter nights without Monty. In those early days, he He was more than just a companion. He was a living being I could care for when I wasn't connecting much with others. He gave me something tangible to nurture and love. So here are seven important points from the talk today. First, the dana, our offering, is the foundation of all four embracing actions. So dana is the foundation. Loving speech is an offering that uses language. Beneficial action is an offering using body and mind. And identity action is a method we can use to make our offerings acceptable to others. Second, we should take pity on a cornered tortoise and care for a sick sparrow. When we see this tortoise or sparrow, we try to help them without expecting any reward. We are motivated solely by beneficial action itself. Third, in Buddhism, our ability to love our enemies determines our ability to be bodhisattvas. Fourth, Dogen Zenji taught in the Shishobo that we should act in accordance with what is best for the sake of all beings. So basically, when you're not sure what to do, just say in your head, what would be best for the sake of all beings? That's a good standard of measure for how you should proceed if you're confused. What would be best for all beings? Fifth, sometimes people even beat or threw stones at Bodhisattva, never disparaging, that as long as he lived, he did not stop his practice of honoring everyone he met. So we can develop our own little practices. We can always do whatever. I think he's a really good example. Sixth, because beneficial actions never regress, if we attain such a mind, we can perform beneficial action even for grass, trees, wind, and water. We should strive solely to help ignorant beings. This was Dogen's faith and wish. And lastly, if a person performs a generous act without any expectation of personal gain, the person does receive a reward. If the person has even the slightest expectation of any reward, however, the action is defiled and the person definitely is not rewarded. And then this part, I have two ideas for your deep reflection during the week, and these will be posted. And the point is to choose one of them, to choose one of these two ideas to really think about and ideally write about. The first one, how can we transform our consciousness and go beyond a sense of separation from other human beings? How can we do that? As a result of developments in science, technology, transportation, and communication, the world of human beings have the potential to become one community. Thus, people from different racial, religious, and cultural backgrounds must communicate and interact with each other. Unless we find some common ground, one on which people can live knowing they are connected to each other, human beings will not be able to live together peacefully. Our resources are diminished. Even our planet may not last. So the question to think about is reviewing your own life from this perspective. Write about one event in which finding common ground has been a struggle. For example, Okamura Roshi has written about learning to like and trust Americans after the Hiroshima bombs destroyed the whole of his family's wealth in one night, in addition, of course, to causing massive other damage. Yet the United States had brought democracy to Japan and other things like electronics, science, technology, movies, and music. It seemed like a paradise of materialistic culture. So his view of the United States became confused. The monk in the story today, likewise, was convinced that there was no place for a dog in his monastery until his heart made an unexpected turn toward compassion. We have so much to learn from this kind of inner battle. Good to go over all the details. So that's one choice for your deep thought, I think, this week. The second one is, in Buddhism, our ability to love our enemies determines our ability to be bodhisattvas. And Dogen Zenji taught in the Shishobo that we should act in accordance with what is best for the sake of all beings. Please choose from among the many disastrous conditions going on in our world right now, one that you would like to address with a heartfelt letter to the universe. Writing your thoughts and feelings down will help you both to clarify and preserve them for either further clarification. Perhaps you will find a place to publish and share your views with others. Maybe it will make a difference. So pick one of those and really, really think about it as seriously as you can. They're both very profound and provocative issues related to beneficial action. I wonder if you have questions.
So the first question that we got is, if a person performs a generous act without any expectation of personal gain, although rewards for the action are not important to that person, the person does receive a reward. If the person has even the slightest expectation of any reward, However, the action is defiled and the person definitely is not rewarded. This is a strange logic and easy to get twisted. It would be easy to think of oneself as expecting no reward for one's beneficial action, all the while smugly knowing that a reward will be coming. It seems to all depend on a really deep level of personal integrity. Most people don't have that, I don't think.
I know. And I think Dogen is setting a really high bar for personal integrity. I mean, he certainly had stellar personal integrity. Don't forget, a lot of his teaching was to laymen who wrote him letters asking for advice. You can read, "Dear Dogen, what should I do about my cat?" I always think about that and chuckle. But, you know, you can watch your own mind. You can watch yourself. Just like the man who wrote the story about Monty caught himself. Well, maybe this wasn't entirely, you know, a pure beneficial action, because I might have been thinking, well, aren't I a good person doing a good deed right now? You know, these little thoughts sneak in. You can watch yourself going back and forth like that. And I think that the consciousness is, if you have that consciousness, that's enough. That we don't have to actually get there. We just have to know where we are exactly. We have to know exactly where we are. And also, though, sometimes we do, just like the man who wrote the story, sometimes we do a beneficial action without even thinking about it, like when he carried box turtles across the road. We can refer back to our own pure beneficial action as a, first of all, a gauge. Check how did you feel inside when you did that pure beneficial action, and then go back to, do you feel that again? You can check whether that was really a pure beneficial action by a previous one that you managed to do just without even thinking about it. We're all capable, and I'm sure we've all actually done spontaneously a good deed or been helpful to others, even that just happens on the street, you know. Somebody drops something and you just go and pick it up for them. I see this all the time. So we have our own beneficial actions as guides to what a beneficial action really does feel like inside. And we have examples from others, and all we need to really do is be conscious of where our state of mind is. You know, are we in one of those things of telling ourselves this is really a beneficial action, this is a pure beneficial action, when actually we're calculating, oh, I know, but anyway, I'll get a reward anyway. It's interesting. And I'm just saying, consciousness is everything. And we don't have to get all the way there. We can just get to as far as consciousness of where we actually are. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. And I think there's this follow-up question to that Dogen says that our actions are either pure or defiled. But how do we know, though? People do all kinds of selfish things, truly believing that they're doing the right thing. Can we trust our own judgment?
You can trust that your own judgment will grow, and that if you make an effort to develop yourself psychologically and spiritually in some way, your inner sense of correct behavior will deepen. And at some point, you reach a place where you just know. You just know. In Zen, I know I've talked about this a lot, we don't leave tracks. And tracks are leftovers. So a queasy feeling after you do something or a strong heartbeat, or the feeling the writer of the story about Monty had in the pit of his stomach, that did I just do that? You know, I think I just did the wrong thing. Those kind of feelings get more and more accurate. So we develop these indicators. And sometimes we'll have a feeling we just can't override, and we don't override it. And so then our behavior is correct in those cases. But it's all inner work. This is all interior. And living with others really helps, because if you listen to them, they'll correct you in some way or another. And if you listen to being corrected, if you're open to being corrected, you'll learn a lot about yourself, and you'll grow internally, and you'll deepen your ability to just know when an action is pure or defiled. Thank you. I don't have anything more to add to that.
Thank you, Gail. The next one that we got is that in the story about Monty, there is a man who does Zazen in a monastery. He started for others also to practice Zazen. This very man thought it best to turn away a hungry animal because it might disturb people's Zazen. When he did the compassionate thing, it all turned out very differently. I'm surprised someone who was actually starting his own monastery, obviously an experienced practitioner, didn't think of compassion first.
I know, but you know, he might have been thinking of compassion toward the people who are sitting Zazen in his monastery. Don't forget, he went to a lot of trouble to purchase this property and start a monastery, you know, in Northwest Arkansas, in order to promote this very difficult practice in Okamura Roshi's lineage, which is a 5-day, once a month, 5-day sesshin of 14 50-minute periods of Zazen a day. And that's all. There's nothing else. There's no bowing, no chanting, no meals in the Zendo. There's nothing else. It's just Zazen all day long for 5 days, once a month. It's a very severe practice, I think. And he started his own monastery to offer a place to others to do this practice. So, but listen to Suzuki Roshi's definition of Zazen. Listen to this. The mysterious power of showing the appearance of the Buddha in each world in each pore of the body, that is actually Zazen practice. When you practice Zazen in its true sense, actually you're Buddha himself. And in each pore of your body, you have so many worlds. And in each of the worlds, there's Shakyamuni Buddha. This is an explanation of our shikantaza, our just sitting. So basically he's saying that Zazen is compassion. Each pore of our body contains universes. I mean, many worlds, and each world contains Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, and Buddha is compassion. So it's kind of another piece of strange logic, actually. I think there was compassion, but it wasn't compassion for the dog. It was compassion for the Zendo, the people who came and worked so hard in the Zendo at this difficult practice. That's my most generous explanation. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So the next one that we have is, so somebody said, I'm thinking about the fact that when Dogen wrote, therefore we should equally benefit friends and foes alike. We should benefit self and others alike. He was in so much conflict with the political and religious powers of Kyoto that he had to flee. So his actual enemies, he included in his resolve to benefit all beings. That's a powerful example. Most of us shrivel in our ethical and humanistic beliefs in the face of dangerous political power.
I know as a Jew, I often ask myself what I would have done if I had lived it through the Holocaust. And I think I would have done anything I could do to save my life, but I really doubt if I would have prayed for Hitler. I can't picture it, actually. And in Buddhism, as I said today, our ability to love our enemies determines our ability to be a bodhisattva. We can't be a bodhisattva until we can love our enemies. Dogen was a bodhisattva for sure. So thinking this way really shows me how far I have to go. I'm not close to, you know, loving Putin. I'm just not. But, you know, I've heard Reb say, this was not about Putin, this was about, I'm not sure who it was about, but someone not in whatever his camp is. And he said he would be curious to hear what the person had to say. And I remember thinking that I'm not so sure I was curious about, with, you know, a person in a radically different view, a radically different viewpoint, had to, like Putin. I'm not sure I was all that interested in hearing their viewpoint. And I realized that, you know, right at that moment, I saw, you know, Reb is so much more developed than I am. And it was a real eye-opener. Well, I see I have to stop. And we have one more meeting on the Shishobo next Sunday. And then we'll be taking a break. And next Sunday, I'll let you know for sure when we'll re-begin, and it'll be probably in mid-February. I think I've mentioned that I'm taking the month of January off to do a Zen practice intensive at Green Gulch Farm with Reb. All right. And I want to be sure to thank everybody who's helped make this talk possible, all these talks possible, Brendan and Sahar and Brian, and yourselves for attending, and those of you who attend during the week. I'm so grateful. And I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.